Coming up on Tech News Weekly, we round up some of the news from the RSA and our SA security conferences. Also, LeapMotion's new plan to improve hand tracking inside of augmented reality systems, the cellular industry cover-up of science that shows the effects of RF radiation, and the Department of Defense is looking for a viable cloud service bachelor. Who will get the rose? All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 28, recorded Thursday, April 19th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/TWiT.
And by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions, drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term purposeful relationships with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, visit linkedin.com/TNW.
Oh, hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly. I felt like I needed to do that because it was on me.
Welcome. This is a show where we love to talk about the news, who made it, who broke it, making and breaking the news, the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Breaking tech news is not a bad thing, right? It's not like it's destroyed and you can never get anything positive or good out of it.
At the end of the show, we make everything back.
We glue it all together again.
We do. So this week, it's the annual RSA Security Conference that takes over San Francisco. Here to talk about this event, as well as the sister event, our SA, is Ian Scher, CNET News Executive Editor for the West Coast. Welcome back to the show, Ian.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. So what were the big headlines this year at RSA?
It was the sister event, RSA, O-U-R. And it was a reaction to the fact that when RSA was setting up the keynotes for the event, that they didn't have practically any women. There was only one, I think, out of 20 keynotes, which, you know, the cybersecurity world definitely lacks for gender diversity, but not that much. And so there was a lot of reaction to it, and someone decided to, or a couple of people decided to put together a competing event, O-U-R-S-A, and basically try to show, no, women really do know what they're doing, and there are a lot of them in cybersecurity, and all you have to do is ask because they get them on stage. So they talked about all sorts of stuff like, the typical stuff that you would hear at RSA, right? Different tools and different capabilities. But they also talked about how cybersecurity bleeds into social issues and how really the companies need to do a lot better job of not talking in just impossible jargon, which is a huge problem in the tech industry, but especially in cybersecurity.
So it started as just for women, but it was also underrepresented minorities in general were there as well. So there was only one woman in the first speaker list. And was that one woman, Monica Lewinsky?
Monica Lewinsky was definitely one of the keynotes, and that was a big deal. I think she was the first one. And then we also had DHS Secretary Kristen Nielsen also came and spoke. And both of them were really fascinating. I mean, I don't know if you've listened to Monica Lewinsky's TED Talk before, but it's a really fascinating conversation because she calls herself kind of patient zero of the modern kind of attack machine that happens on the internet these days. And really, like, everything about the Bill Clinton sex scandal happened online, right? It was broken by the Drudge Report. It just, everything moved very quickly online in a way that really had never happened before. And then Kristen Nielsen was really fascinating too, the Secretary of Homeland Security. She talked about how the United States, you know, reserves the right to be able to cyber attack other countries that are attacking us. And I think that's something everyone knew, but it was interesting for her to spell it out.
Yeah. One thing that caught my eye from RSA was something that they were talking about, the cybersecurity tech accord, which seemed like a bunch of different companies kind of banded together to make a united front when it comes to technology, you know, security and how they're sharing that with governments. Who exactly is involved with that, and what exactly are they promising through that?
Yeah, so it's pretty much all the names you would expect, right? Microsoft, Facebook, a lot of people you know. And the thing behind it really, it kind of sounds like common sense and stuff we've heard from them before, which is that they don't want to help governments attack other people or other governments and whatnot. And that's not a new thing. But what's interesting is that they're all kind of banding together and making this accord together and really speaking as one voice. And I think that after we saw, for example, the FBI pick the fight with Apple about making them try and hack into that terrorist's iPhone and all sorts of other stuff that happened, that really this is one of those moments where the tech industry is saying, no, we unequivocally don't want to help you when it comes to stuff that challenges our own ethics.
And then, you know, obviously there's a long list. What is it? 34 companies that are all agreeing to this. What about the companies that didn't? Because there are some big name companies, I mean, some of the biggest name companies in technology that aren't on this list. Do we have any understanding as to why exactly they didn't want to take part in this?
In my experience, there's a lot of reasons why people don't join lists. For example, one of my favorite examples was back when I was at the Wall Street Journal covering Apple. Apple would pretty often not be on these lists for being a part of green efforts, right? And doing all sorts of stuff around making sure stuff was more recyclable or not using specific materials in their computers. And it was interesting because if you dug into the details, Apple actually was already doing everything that the people had pledged to do. And so when you push the company, you're like, why aren't you doing this? A lot of the sense that I got back from it was that, well, we don't want to be on a list, right? Like, we're doing it on our own anyway. And so I think that that's something to keep in mind, is that just because a company's not on some list or hasn't made an official pledge doesn't mean that they're not doing it anyway.
Mm-hmm. So I have one more question about the Our SA conference. Is that something that's going to continue? Are they joining with the RSA? I know that RSA added a few more women after the backlash.
After the pressure. Yeah.
So is this going to continue, or is it just a one-off?
Well, the organizers of RSA say that if there is another one next year, they feel like they'll have failed. They really want to make sure that the RSA, the official conference, is much more inclusive. And if it does that, then they're happy. And I think that that's really a smart thing to do. Whenever you're doing kind of a political protest thing, having a really good point to your protest and a point where you succeeded is always a good thing. And it's also a good kind of measure of RSA that if they feel like they need to run another, you know, competing conference or whatever RSA, O-U-R-S-A conference again, then that's a sign to the industry that they are not living up to what they need to do.
It helps to have a good name, too, with a pun,
yes.
Sort of.
Although they sound talking, so right? Similar. Yeah, I know. They sound so similar. Some of the meaning ends up
writing.
Getting lost.
Yeah. Yes, it's great in writing. It's terrible when I'm talking.
So let's move on to some Facebook news. We have to keep talking about it. You had a great piece about the fallout of last week's congressional hearings with Mark Zuckerberg. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so one of the interesting kind of threads, I went to Washington. I sat in those very uncomfortable chairs and watched for 10 hours of testimony. And the thing that I thought was really fascinating was, you know, there was the conversation last week about how the Senate basically doesn't understand the internet, which, you know, if you follow the Senate pretty closely, that's not a new thing. It's just unfortunate that it's still the truth. But the other thing that was going on was that there was very clearly all sides of Congress want to do something about this issue, and they want to show that they can stand up to Silicon Valley after three decades of basically doing nothing. And what was interesting is I spoke to Adam Schiff, who's on the Intelligence Committee in the House, and also Mark Warner, who's on the Intelligence Committee in the Senate. Both of them have been very involved in tech issues, and both of them gave me the impression that the biggest thing that needs to happen first is that they feel like their colleagues just need to understand what technology is and what's going on here before they can even get close to regulating it. And that's a really key thing, because it means that, A, the industry is safe for now, except for the FTC, which might jump in. But secondly, that Congress is not really able to do their jobs, and that's a little disappointing.
Yeah, and I think it was yesterday that Facebook basically is starting to kind of lay out details as far as how it plans to kind of improve its privacy laws everywhere. And we heard a little bit about this during the actual, Mark Zuckerberg's testimony, that the European GDPR, their plan is to expand that everywhere, right? Do we have more idea of what that actually translates to in practice?
Yeah. So Facebook's argument so far has been basically that whatever the GDPR is, they'll not only be in compliance, but they're basically going to make it available to everyone else in the world. Because one of the things about Facebook that's always been consistent is that they don't want to have different rules in different countries, because then that's a lot of work for them. They'd rather have one set of rules that applies everywhere. And that's very tough, and it doesn't always work, as we've seen recently. But it is something that they strive toward. And so they argued, Mark Zuckerberg, when he was on the Hill, said, you know, whether or not they are exactly following the GDPR, these increased privacy rules are going to be the same for pretty much everyone around the world. That's going to be really fascinating. There's still a lot of kind of questions in the air. There's a lot of questions about how GDPR is going to apply to all of us. You know, one of the things that's been going on is that we've seen with other tech companies that basically GDPR has forced all the tech companies to increase our privacy in the United States. And that's pretty interesting. But it might be that there might be some pushback. There might be some companies that decide, well, we don't want to have it apply to the United States. And then, of course, Congress is considering whether or not to take up a version of the GDPR for the United States. There's all these weird things going on. But again, I mean, one of the things I've spoken to a lot of people about, and both of the people I spoke to on the Hill, said it's at least good that we're having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Another thing you touch on in your piece, which I highly recommend everyone going to read on CNET, is about the Honest Ads Act. And that's something that that's one thing that I've not understood at all. Like, I understand regulation in terms of privacy is very difficult, but every TV political ad, we make fun of it. You know, I approve this message, this is paid for by so-and-so, but then that doesn't exist online. So tell us about the Honest Ads Act.
Right. So this law, which, by the way, was introduced by Mark Warner, is really the whole idea is to get the internet in line with everyone else. So as you mentioned, you know, TV and radio, it usually has to say, I am so-and-so and I've approved this ad, or this ad has been funded by the XYZ corporation for whatever. And those things have been very consistent. Those laws are very clear. But on the internet, it's never been that case. And so especially during the Russian meddling concerns during the 2016 election and beyond, we've noticed that one of the things was that there were a lot of politically focused ads that had no names behind them. And that's a huge problem because it allows people to, for example, meddle in our election when they're outside countries, something that would never happen on TV or radio. It wouldn't be allowed. So getting everything in line, making sure that if you are doing a political ad in the United States, that you are registered, that you have that you're following the law, that you're disclosing who you are, those things are key. And Facebook, by the way, has already said that they are trying to set up those rules now. So even if the Honest Ads Act doesn't pass by the time of 2018 election or the 2020 election, at least they have a policy in place. And then Twitter as well, and don't forget them, they have said that they support this law as well. So this is the most likely piece of regulation to go through in legislation on this issue, at least, you know, that's going to be applying to the internet. Anything else, privacy and all that stuff, there's a lot of question marks above it.
Ian Scher is the West Coast Executive Editor for CNET News, where he writes about cybersecurity, Microsoft VR games, and more. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Send us your selfies.
Yeah, apparently.
We want your selfies. I wanted to thank Jim, who sent us this photo of how he listens to Tech News Weekly working on his birthday last Saturday.
How do we know you're actually listening to anything?
It's true. Jim lives in a cold place.
Yeah, no kidding.
So whether you live in a cold place or a warm place or in between, we want to see how you listen, see how you watch. Send your selfies to tnw@twit.tv.
Yep, and you too will be on the show. Gesture control, it's an important immersive component, potentially has a lot of implications for how immersive VR and augmented reality can be. Leap Motion is a brand that we're very familiar with because they've long been in the gesture interface game. First, they created systems like the Leap for unique desktop control that did really cool things there. And then later, introducing Orion with the express goal of paving the challenging path to hand tracking within VR. Their latest announcement is taking them one step further. And joining us to talk about Project North Star is Alex Colgan. He's the Senior Director of Marketing and Community for Leap Motion. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hey, Jason. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to get you here. So let's first start with the idea behind this project, and that is obviously getting developers to use Leap Motion's hand tracking software on their platforms. Is that right?
Well, ultimately, the concept behind Project North Star was we wanted to be able to prototype user experience design and aesthetics for augmented reality with something that felt like a product from the future. In our own development, we often encountered compromises that have been built into existing augmented reality headsets. And the issue there was that if you're trying to anticipate what augmented reality is going to look like in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, the systems that are going to exist at that point in time are not going to have the limitations of the systems that exist right now. It kind of like imagining, you know, trying to prototype phone interactions if you have a display on for a phone that's about the size of a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. So what we decided to do was essentially build our own system, one that didn't have any of those compromises built into place. In essence, we went completely towards functionality and set the question of form factor aside completely. And then when we had the functionality that we wanted, we worked our way backwards in order to get a form factor that could be as comfortable as possible while still providing the functionality that we wanted. And Project North Star is a headset, but it's also the design explorations that have been taking place on top of that. So a lot of what people have been seeing over the past few weeks have been the results of some of those explorations, things like wearable interfaces or things like the aesthetics of augmented reality, where we're really working our way through thinking around what augmented reality is going to look and feel like and what it means when we're interacting with objects that aren't made of atoms but are made out of light.
So the design that you released is open source, so people can build their own. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, where do they get the hardware if they want to build this?
Yeah, the thought process behind open sourcing it was really that we're not ultimately in the business of making augmented reality headsets. Instead, our focus is on hand tracking. So we wanted to be able to make a lot of the discoveries that we made as part of Project North Star available to the world at large. As part of that, it is worth bearing in mind that there are some components that are going to be outside of the reach of, everyday makers and tinkerers. Some of the components are rather more difficult to produce or to get produced than others. But ultimately, by making these components available, the hope is that it's going to not only accelerate the conversation around what augmented reality can be and what types of form factors that we might see that beyond the sort of typical glasses that you might see, but also to try to accelerate this conversation around what augmented reality design is.
Right. And when you're talking about the hardware specs, not only is it the, you know, based on the open source license and the information that you publish, not only is it kind of obviously the kind of trademark, the signature for Leap Motion with the hand controls and stuff. But right. You're also talking about a very, like the display itself is very different, right? You're talking about a very wide field of view for AR, which, I mean, we've all heard, you know, the stories of Microsoft's, why am I blanking suddenly? What Microsoft's?
HoloLens.
HoloLens, thank you. Where HoloLens, you put it on, you hear all these great things, and then you put it on, and it's this little, you know, postage stamp of a window, which kind of pulls a little bit of that immersion out. But what you have here is very different. It seems like a much wider field of view. How important is that for something like this?
For something like what we're trying to accomplish, the field of view is very important. Microsoft is in the position of building something that they want to be able to release at scale and have it be the first of a line of different consumer products. So with that, they do have to make this compromise between what the form factor is, how big it is, versus the core functionality underneath it. again, we wanted to create something with the highest possible technical specifications and then kind of throw everything else off to the side. So we made the decision fairly early on to go with what's called birdbath optics as opposed to flat waveguides. HoloLens and Magic Leap both use a waveguide display system, which essentially refracts the light through a much smaller display, whereas a birdbath, as the name suggests, has to be much larger and encompass a much larger field. To some extent, it is rather interesting. I think everybody remembers the experience with Google Glass and the lashback that occurred with feeling very alienated being around somebody who was wearing Google Glass and trying to move beyond the sort of dork factor that we kind of frequently run into when it comes to rolling out new technologies, especially ones that people are going to wear on their face. And we feel it should be, you know, fashionable. It should be comfortable. It should blend in to some extent. There is a kind of a social contract that we have to make with the technologies that we wear on our bodies or that we have as part of ourselves. You can think about that in terms of people glancing at their watch too much or people staring at their phones too much. Or when the Walkman first came out, interestingly enough, it came with two ports on it because the idea was that you would share it with a friend because audio isolation was seen as weird and antisocial. And, you know, why would that person want to isolate themselves from everybody else and listen to their own music when they could be sharing it with somebody?
Oh, they had no idea what direction that was going to go. Yeah,
exactly. A few years down the road, that gets pulled out because by then the expectations have changed and the culture has changed and people have a different sense of what's normal. And there is, I think with augmented reality in particular, we're hitting into this area where we are continually trying to hammer down that form factor and find the functionality that's going to be acceptable because form factor is regarded as being so important to having social acceptance of augmented reality in everyday life. To some extent, my own thoughts on that are that you look at, say, Pokemon Go, for example, where you have people staring at their phones and tramping through fields and waving things around in the air and trying to catch things that aren't there, but people enjoy it, and it went viral because it was something that you could do socially and something that you could do with other people. So for augmented reality to take off, I think ultimately, rather than thinking that we have to reach some sort of compromise between functionality and form factor, ultimately it is going to come down to being able to socialize augmented reality, being able to bridge people using these augmented reality headsets so that they can have a sort of shared world between them rather than everybody looking at their own worlds in isolation.
And that's a big question. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, that was my big question because there's a lot of, you know, on the Leap Motion blog, you talk about how we're on a precipice of change and, you know, human experience is changing. And I keep thinking of, you know, the dystopian version of that, Ready Player One, and just, you know, WALL-E. So how do you change that? How do you keep people from being isolated in virtual reality or augmented reality?
Yeah, I mean, technology is ultimately a reflection of ourselves. So it's going to bring out the best of us and it's going to bring out the worst in us. I mean, we saw that with the mobile revolution where the mobile phones and the platforms that were built on them brought people a lot closer together, but it also had very destructive consequences. The way that we avoid that is that we think very long and hard and have discussions about what kind of future it is that we want to build, what that future should look like. I am actually a very big fan of dystopian fiction because it throws up a lot of warning signs and gives us touch points that we can talk about in terms of not building the world that we don't want to live in, but building a world that we genuinely want to live in and reshaping the human experience in a way that's positive.
that hopefully avoids all those things that in some ways seem to be happening already.
Absolutely.
So what about the price point? Obviously, for this, based on the pricing of the components, now, like you said, you guys aren't getting in the headset hardware business.
Right.
But this is open source, under $100 to produce at scale. What exactly does that mean?
So grinding a lens once is quite expensive. You can kind of compare it to, you know, making a custom car chassis. Doing it once and setting it up once is quite pricey. Doing it subsequent times and setting up, you know, molds, less pricey. Setting up a production line, substantially less pricey. One of the benefits of a birdbath optical system is that it is relatively inexpensive to produce at scale, particularly when you compare it to a flat waveguide-based system. So when we say at scale, we do mean at scale. If you were producing, you know, tens of thousands of such headsets, then all of the per-unit costs associated with that go down as you are able to, you know, take advantage of mass manufacturing.
It sounds like you have given this a lot of thought, which is a breath of fresh air when you're talking to marketing people in VR and AR. So thank you. And it makes me think of, I mean, you guys have been around for a long time. The idea was started a decade ago, and there's been a lot of, the hype cycle has gone all over the place. And I think maybe we're in sort of a low area. It seems like that to me. And it makes me think of the Bill Gates quote. You know, we overestimate the things that are going to change in technology in the next 5 years, and we underestimate the things that are going to change in the next 10 years. So, like, can you talk a little bit about, like, what's the long-term plan here? Like, do you get frustrated when people are like, oh, VR is over?
Oh, absolutely. VR is not over by any stretch of the imagination. I think that we've seen a slowdown in some key areas. Mobile and standalone VR in particular have been slower to develop than most people had anticipated. And we're also still, you know, as the blog post said, kind of very much on this precipice. Once VR and augmented reality, you know, it will sort of flesh itself out a little further out. But once VR really starts to take off in terms of standalone systems that are not only able to operate based off of their own processors, but are able to leverage things that are happening around them. Once VR and the Internet of Things start to become patched together more and more, we're going to see an acceleration, and there's going to be this sort of tipping point. We did have, again, I hate to keep comparing it to the mobile revolution, but we did have this long period of, you know, very big brick phones, and we had Blackberries, and we had, you know, other phones that allowed us to make phone calls and had some very basic pieces of functionality besides, like maybe a few games, but they didn't change the world in quite the same way as they did in the latter half of the 2010s, where the iPhone was released and then Android phones start hitting the market and true smartphones really start to overturn things, shaking up entire industries to a very large extent, giving birth to massive companies and fundamentally changing how we live and work every single day. At this, 15 years ago, we weren't cyborgs, and to some extent, we kind of have become cyborgs at this point, where the phone is an extension of ourselves, and it's always on our person, and it's something that we always have and that we can use to connect with all of the world's information, or all of our friends, or be able to do things that are fun, or creative, or playful, or learn, and that is something that happened to, in one way, very, very quickly, but in another way, slower than a lot of people thought, especially if you think about how people were talking about, like, the internet in the early 90s.
Yeah, it's almost like where we're at right now with VR is Motorola StarTAC, and then soon we're going to move into the touchscreen era, and that's when it's going to really blow your mind.
I know. I would also say, I think it was William Gibson who said that the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. Mm-hmm. And we see that very much in our everyday lives.
Yeah, right on. Awesome stuff. Alex Colgan with Leap Motion, leapmotion.com, if people want to find out more about the open source information that you guys posted.
Awesome. Yep.
Right on. Thank you, Alex. Thanks. We really appreciate your time. Take care. And best of luck.
Bye.
All right, coming up, is cell phone radiation the tobacco of our day? A very controversial topic there, and we've got a great interview lined up. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Weekly, and that is LastPass. LastPass, you probably already know LastPass. I'm a huge fan of LastPass. They keep your passwords organized and secure and right at your fingertips. There are too many passwords to remember. We know this. We realize this. We want better habits when it comes to managing our passwords, whether it's managing your personal accounts or securing your workplace credentials. LastPass makes password security effortless. You just remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. If you happen to be reusing the same password over and over, let's face it, we're all guilty of this at one point or another. LastPass will generate and store strong, unique passwords. It comes up with them on the fly at the moment that you're signing up for a new site or changing your passwords to keep you safe and secure. LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer, say a desktop or laptop, or even on your mobile device. It does it anywhere that you need it to. You can explore your LastPass vault. You can easily add, view, and manage items that you've saved. LastPass Enterprise simplifies password management for companies of every size with the tools that you need to secure your business and be confident with that security while centralizing control of employee passwords and apps. And did you know that over 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords? It's no surprise. We're always told to strengthen our passwords, but it's really hard to manage those things if you don't have something, a tool dedicated to that task. LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees, so it empowers you to stay more secure. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. And sensitive data is encrypted at the device level with AES 256 to protect from man-in-the-middle attacks. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of LastPass. I've been using it for years. And I feel like my password security has never been stronger than it is now. And it keeps getting stronger because it's always installed. So every time I sign up for a new site, I'm not reusing an old password. It's a brand new one, never used before. It gets saved. I never even have to remember it. I just remember my master password and I'm good to go. LastPass, by the way, also has other products besides Enterprise for Business. There's LastPass Premium for personal use. That's what we have. LastPass Families for your entire family. There's also LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more today by going to lastpass.com/twit. That's lastpass.com/twit and see which product is right for you. The cover story of the April 23rd edition of The Nation magazine focuses on something that we've heard a lot about over the years, but until very recently had little conclusive evidence to even point to: the issue of cell phone radiation and what its effects might be on the humans that live, breathe, maybe obsess over the technology every waking hour of the day. And even deeper than that, kind of talking about the industry that may or may not be complicit in either letting that information see the light of day or hiding it from the public. Joining us to talk about some recent discoveries and dive a little deeper into this issue is Mark Herskard, the Nation's investigative editor and co-author of How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, a Special Investigation. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So first of all, you specify in your article that you aren't necessarily arguing that wireless technology is dangerous or is not, but rather that the cell phone industry has long campaigned that they are safe when in fact there are reasons to believe that it might not be so. So I guess let's start there. Talk a little bit about kind of the underpinnings, the foundation of your investigation here.
Sure. The reasons that exist are, ironically enough, the very science that the cell phone industry itself funded back in the 1990s. They put together a research program, and their own scientist told them at the end of that, we have the smoking gun letter dated October 7, 1999, to the CEO of AT&T and the CEOs of 27 other major companies that headed the trade association for the wireless industry. And that letter from Dr. George Carlo said that there were serious questions about the possibility of cell phone radiation causing both cancer and genetic damage. Now, that letter from 1999 made it clear there was not definitive proof of this, these dangers, but rather that there were serious questions about it. And in particular, the scientists said that the industry should not be telling customers that this is perfectly safe and certainly shouldn't be saying that about children. And what's interesting about that to me is we see here the parallel between big wireless and how it used the very same public relations playbook that big tobacco pioneered and big oil perfected to lie to the public about their products. And in both of those previous cases, big tobacco and big oil, just like big wireless, were told privately by their own scientists that their technologies caused real, or raised, I should say, real health risks. And what did those industries do? They kept those warnings to themselves. And when they spoke to the public, they acted like there was absolutely no problem. In fact, they actively denied that there was a problem.
It's so interesting that you compare it to tobacco and other older industries, because I think of this as really a problem of our time, the time of Twitter, and I hate to use the term, but fake news. You write that the industry doesn't have to win the scientific argument about safety. It only has to keep the argument going. And it feels like that is so easy when we're just like reading 140 characters and not really paying attention. And we just kind of want to believe what we want to believe. Either we want to believe that, you know, that every cell phone is going to cause cancer, or we want to believe like, no, they're fine and we love them. So, I mean, how is this really different in this age of just fast internet?
I think you're right that it is easier now for an industry to create the appearance of doubt. But it very definitely was something that big oil and big tobacco did as well, even long before there was Twitter and 140 characters that were dominating the public discourse. You know, it's interesting, even though all of us sort of know that smoking cigarettes can give you lung cancer, the power of that industry is so great, political power, that those products are still out there to be sold and bought by the consumer. Those are products that, when used as directed, will kill you. And yet, there they are out there in the marketplace. Likewise with climate change. The overwhelming scientific consensus says that we are racing towards absolute climate catastrophe on this planet. And yet the political power of those corporations is so great that we continue to advance and expand our production of fossil fuels. So I think that the real lesson here is that all of us need to be very wary of corporate power. And the ideology of a corporation is always to grow, to get bigger, to put profits ahead of every other consideration. And I think that's very, very pervasive in our political economy. And that's why we thought this story was so important to do, because, as you say, everyone is using this technology now.
Yeah, and using is an understatement. I mean, everyone is living on this technology. You know, so
and they're addicted to this technology.
For
and that's
sure.
Another parallel. You know, big tobacco consciously addicted its customers by adding nicotine to their cigarettes. And big wireless, we now know, the top people have now confessed to this, that they consciously, deliberately addict people, giving you little dopamine rushes with your likes on Twitter and Facebook. So it's a very insidious enterprise that we're talking about here.
Sure. And I feel like there's a little bit, like, I feel like the conversation has changed a little bit in this. Last month, the U.S. National Toxicology Program showed what they said to be clear evidence of heart tumors in rats after exposure to RF radiation. And this happened after a peer review that actually upgraded its conclusions. Prior to that, the conclusions were much more leveled. But afterwards, after peer review, they did what doesn't happen very often. They upgraded it to say that it is it shows clear evidence of a direct relation here. Would you say that this is a big turning point in our understanding, or does that just cloud things with what you also talk about, which is the wargaming of science?
I think it could be a big change in our understanding with one huge caveat here, which is that there's almost been no mass media coverage of that National Toxicology Program peer review.
That's true.
So how can the average American know about this if you're not hearing about it from television or radio or websites and news outlets.
I think there's a real problem, too, because I think the tech press has been accused of ignoring this issue, because if I tell you that cell phone that's in your hand might cause cancer, then you're going to put it down and stop looking at the ads on my tech website. Yeah. And so, you know, we've been accused of that. But there's also, like, I that's not the way. I mean, responsible journalists don't act that way. But my thing is, I believe in science. So I've always said, well, there's been no scientific proof. But you point out that lack of definitive proof that a technology is harmful does not mean that it's safe. So, you know, am I going to continue to hand over a cell phone to my 13-year-olds and, you know, whose brains have not been fully developed? You know, is that smart? So it's really complicated. I feel like it is different than tobacco or oil, because you do have not just the information, but you have all these, you know, geeky people like us saying, like, give me the science, show me the science. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's safe if there hasn't been any science to say that it's not safe.
Well, I hear what you're saying there. It's a logical fallacy to think that because we don't have definitive proof that something is dangerous, that it is safe. But so, you know, and our article was not about trying to litigate the question of whether the cell phones are safe or not. But in the process of investigating, we did come across a fairly interesting fact, I think, which is that most of the science that is cataloged by the National Institutes of Health, you can go to their database, most of the studies do show a health impact, either related to cancer or genetic damage to DNA breakage and so forth. Most of them do show that. And this gets back to the previous point about how industry keeps the argument going. Very, very few news articles have gone to the trouble of looking at those data that's there inside the NIH database and saying, wow, you know, actually, most of the science does show an impact. Now, why is that? Well, partly it's because, again, like big tobacco and big oil, big wireless has funded its own science to say, surprise, surprise, that there's no health impacts. And so one of the things that we came across in investigating this piece is the huge difference between science that is independently funded by, say, universities or public agencies, and the science that is industry funded. Industry funded science of cell phone radiation's health effects is 2.5 times less likely to find a health impact than independently financed science. That should tell you a lot, and it should make you worried about whether you should give a cell phone to your 13-year-old child. I have a 13-year-old daughter myself.
Sure, sure. Now, another interesting point from the article. I mean, it's a fascinating article. Definitely need to read it. Not, you know, and like you're saying, it's not necessarily about is it safe or not. It's really about kind of the efforts behind the scenes to tell you whether it's safe or not. But The Nation was unable to find any insurance company that would willfully sell a liability policy covering cell phone radiation. What does that seem to imply based on what you guys were looking into?
You know, the insurance industry is the world's biggest industry. They are the biggest investors in the world. They tend to take the longer view. They have to. Obviously, you're insuring things for 20, 30 years. They know what the science says. They know that there's all kinds of liability lawsuits out there and that the science is not as clear cut as the industry says. And so one of the guys that the insurance execs we talked to literally laughed when we asked, could you write us a policy? He said, why would we do that? And I think that tells you that when the money is on the line, the big money does not want to risk. And they know that the science is by no means as clear cut as the big wireless industry wants to tell us.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. I'm really happy that we had the opportunity to get you on the show. Mark Herskard with The Nation, thenation.com. Definitely check out this week's cover story on the magazine, and you can read all about it. You can also find it online. Mark, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this today.
Well, thank you for including me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you soon, and take care.
After the break, the Pentagon is moving to the cloud, and a Vegas casino gets hacked through its fish tank. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Yep, I'm doing an ad about how to get the right eyeballs on your ads. It's very meta. Because when it comes to marketing your business, it's all about connecting with the right audience when and where your message will resonate the most. And you want to target your customers where they are every day and when they're ready to make a decision. And LinkedIn can help. When you advertise on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, you have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers. Relationships that can often translate into high-quality leads, website traffic, and higher brand awareness. The first step, talking to the right audience. Every day, over 500 million professionals engage with content on LinkedIn. I've been trying to use LinkedIn more, and I'm like, oh, well, everybody's having a party here. This is great. Chances are your future customers are among those in that party. LinkedIn has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision down to their job title, company name, and industry. Better targeting equals a message your customers care about, which in turn leads to more trust built with your customers. 4 to 5 customers on LinkedIn are decision makers at their companies, so you're building relationships that really matter. Promote your business with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, go to linkedin.com/TNW. That's linkedin.com/TNW for your free $100 ad credit. Terms and conditions apply, and we thank LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support. Like the rest of us, the Pentagon is moving to the cloud, but who will it choose to be its cloud service provider? The president's favorite punching bag, Amazon. What about Microsoft, a company that already has connections to the DoD? Our last guest today says that Google is quietly pursuing the Pentagon and attempting to hide that fact from its employees. Patrick Tucker, technology editor for Defense One, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So you write that last August, U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis spent a day meeting with Sergey Brin and Sundar Pichai. Google was trying to woo Mattis with tales of their success in cloud computing and AI. You say this wasn't a sales pitch, or they say it wasn't a sales pitch. So what was it?
Right. Well, you know, the way a very good Silicon Valley company does a sales pitch is that you don't feel like it's a sales pitch, but you do walk away from that encounter with the impression that you just saw a miracle. And that's kind of the effect of this trip on the Secretary of Defense. He went into this trip where he also met with Amazon, which is very important too. At the same trip that he met with Google, he also met with Amazon. And what he learned, first going into it, very skeptical of the idea that the entire Department of Defense should move to a commercial cloud service provider as opposed to a whole bunch of dinky little half Pentagon, half tiny cloud service providers. This is what they have now. He, after a day of meetings with Amazon and also with Google, he walked away convinced that in order for the Pentagon to reach its most ambitious future plans, where they're delivering stuff from a single source to soldiers at the front lines, to platforms like drones, F-35 stealth aircraft, F-22s, naval vessels, every object that might be flung at combat ever, they needed a commercial cloud service provider that was massive, that could actually do this. And Google's soft pitch for how moving to the cloud enabled and affected their business was very much focused on how, because we did all of this pioneering work creating the Google Cloud, this enables us now to be a AI powerhouse. And you can just see how we use these massive cloud resources to send different aspects or of training data, different sort of like annoying things that come with artificial intelligence programming. We're able to just throw enormous compute resources at this. And this is why we're now leading the world in the most important technology of the 21st century. But hey, this is not a pitch. So he left that. They said, I want one cloud for all of our stuff into the future. And based on what they're asking for, there's really only three companies that can do it. Microsoft, and that's just like, they're not the one that's most likely to win, but they are the one that's got the most hustle, I'm told, and they do have those deep contacts with the Defense Department. Amazon, considered in many ways the favorite because they're the only company that's built a secret and top secret cloud already for government, and they've got, you know, they're very interested in more cloud business. And Google, who's pursuing this, as we'll get into, rather quietly, because there's a civil war that's going on within that company about a much smaller aspect of their relationship with the Defense Department, a kind of pilot project that is very much tied to their bid for the big, massive $10 billion over 10 years, one Pentagon Cloud project contract.
Well, we've heard a lot about that in recent months, about how this was a possibility, and internally at Google, some of the employees at Google don't feel very good about the fact that their efforts, their work into artificial intelligence might actually end up, being part of some like weaponized future, a collaboration with the government. You point out in the article that Maven, which is largely what we're talking about here, would not be weaponized or not be used in a weaponized sense necessarily. But my question on that is, not now, but could it become weaponized? Like, could it be used in that sense somewhere down the line? Do you think the folks inside Google who are worried about this have something to authentically be worried about?
Well, I do, because I think that the Defense Department and Google's leaders are speaking it sort of in very different languages. The Defense Department is consistent and has always been very clear. We're not going to give any sort of artificial intelligence the authority to take life directly. But you know what? We sure as heck do want all of those artificially intelligent new products and programs and all of the cloud behind them to help us take life more efficiently, because we're the GD Pentagon, and that's what we do sometimes. So this is about, for them, something that's, they call lethality, which actually is just that, like the entire military becoming more dangerous. And so it's, while the AIs themselves aren't going to be directly involved in making targeting decisions, they are part of an enormous enterprise that will operate, and this is really key, at the forefront of combat. This is not for emails. This is not for old logistics crap. This is for winning 21st century wars. So Google's leadership, in their discussion with the employees about this, has emphasized, hey, all we're doing is helping them with some image classification work. It's really very innocent and very benign. And just because it's not at that threshold where the machine or the program itself is outputting a command to a specific weapon to take a life, doesn't mean it's not playing a really intricate and important and intimate role in that chain of events. So they sort of do have something to worry about, and it's because Google leadership hasn't been super upfront about what the relationship with the Defense Department is, because they're not actually being super upfront about what the Defense Department does. The Defense Department is upfront about that, and as far as they're concerned, they'll just find the partner that actually wants to partner with them on that task.
Are the Google employees the only ones that are upset about this? What about the Amazon employees and Microsoft employees? Are they just like, yeah, fine, whatever, go Iron Man on this, I don't care?
Well, see, it's a really interesting question, because this is really unique, right? I'm sure that there probably are plenty of folks at Amazon that are saying to themselves, or saying perhaps vocally, I'm not super excited about going after this enormous cloud contract. This is a weird way we're going to get married to the Pentagon. And that is what this thing is, really, in a way. It's a marriage to the Pentagon. This thing is for 10 years. You become the cloud provider to the Pentagon in lots of ways, and it changes your company forever. But Amazon and Microsoft have very different internal cultures. You've got to remember, Google was set up sort of in this campus format, right? It's sort of modeled after Stanford. And its branding, its outward face that helped the company to attract all of this great talent, it is like literally cartoony on many days. It's rainbows and sneakers and big plush beanbags and, come and do no evil and make the world a wonderful place. And so, as opposed to Microsoft or even Amazon, their entire brand in terms of recruiting top talent, particularly in emerging fields like AI, has been come with us and make the world better. And these folks in particular didn't sign on to be defense contractors, but also because of the way Google culture works, they have more of an opportunity to speak up. And that's what we saw earlier in April, when more than 3,100 Google employees signed a big letter saying, we don't want to this company to have anything to do with this Project Maven stuff. And Project Maven, I've talked to folks in the Defense Department, they've described this as the Pathfinder. This is kind of the audition for between Google and the Defense Department, a first date to see how well they work together. And I was talking to several folks just this week about the results of that endeavor. They are very pleased. This Project Maven, they've considered to be a wild success in terms of the outputs that they're seeing. And they're going to model in many ways this entire AI center that the Pentagon is going to build on top of how successful that experimentation has been. So that's the thing. Inside of Google, you have this huge civil war brewing. But in terms of the output to the Defense Department, it's very positive. And that makes you think that Google might be a stronger contender for this contract than is letting on, if only they would admit it and say something.
Well, the way you're spelling it out, it almost sounds like Google has a lock. Going back to Amazon, as Megan, you said at the top, you know, President Trump is not a fan. Let's just go ahead and say that. How much influence might that have over the selection? Any at all?
It's not supposed to. The Pentagon is real clear about this, that there's no President Trump's personal animus towards Jeff Bezos or that company is not going to influence this decision. And again, if you look at the requirements that they've put out for this thing, many people, the biggest objection is that it almost looks like it's handing the entire thing to Amazon. You've got 9 months from the time of the contract award to when you deliver to develop a secret and a top secret cloud. Amazon's the only company that's done it, and it took them years. Having said that, if you're making flying cars, you know, and you're doing all of this fantastic stuff that Google is doing, then maybe that's actually not a very ambitious goal. Maybe you have lots of ways to do that much better than Amazon did when they first created that. But Amazon is considered the favorite, the heavy favorite. The question is, does the president hating Amazon get in the way of that? It probably doesn't help Amazon. It's not supposed to hurt them in terms of what Pentagon leaders say, but it's not a great thing to tick off the chief executive in your decisions for contracting. Now, in the weird, this is something that Oracle has taken advantage of, and Oracle's kind of like this strange outside player in all of this. And I can tell you what they're doing is launching a kind of information campaign. Number one, actually meeting with the president in dinners where they say they're not discussing this contract, and yet I think you can presume that they very clearly are. But also sending lots of early signals of protest into the process where they're looking at the requirements, and they come back with like lots of questions that need to be answered. The Pentagon strips their name out, but it looks like big complaints about the way this contract is being organized, and everyone knows that's Oracle. They're feeding information to journalists around Washington, D.C. That's not entirely true. I'm happy to say that on air, that they've been feeding a little bit of misinfo to many of my fellows in the Pentagon press corps about how this contract is working out. And what they want is to basically have the Pentagon start over from scratch with an entirely new idea where they build a whole bunch of little tiny clouds. So that way all the previous cloud providers can make money again. And then you squish it all together in like some Frankenstein cloud, and Oracle gets to be one of the biggest players in the Frankenstein cloud. But even Amazon and Google could have a little bit of it too. And the problem with that is that it's just not what the Pentagon wants at all. It's not what Mattis wants, the Secretary of Defense. I've talked to the Chief of the Air Force. I've talked to the Chief of the Navy. Everybody's on board with this idea. One big cloud makes everything much easier. You can run all sorts of awesome AI experimentation on top of it with whoever you pick in the end. But most importantly, everything's centralized, and that's why you have a cloud in the first place.
Mm. You say also in your article that the Pentagon officials expect the losers to protest whatever decision it is. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, this is something that they kind of know is inevitable, that you're going to run into a protest. And that sort of slows down the process, can be quite a lot. But because they're anticipating it, hopefully that protest, when it comes out, and there's a lot of things that are under protest, and then the protest is pushed aside, and then they go through with that. It's just sort of like a legal tactic that the losers can pull to make a judge certify whether or not this was, you know, done on the up and up. And because they're anticipating that, the protest is not supposed to derail this whole thing. But it is sort of inevitable. An interesting sign of actually how interested in this Google is, particularly in anticipation of a potential protest, they've actually sealed former chairman Eric Schmidt off from any discussion of Project Maven or the cloud pursuit, not even though he's on the Defense Innovation Board. He actually is on a board that advises and consults the Pentagon about what sort of tech it should buy. And he told me this week, in order to avoid any, even the semblance, even the pretense of a conflict of interest, they made a decision incredibly early on to seal him in his role at the Defense Department from his role at Google if there's ever any overlap between the two of them. So to make that decision so early on to take your number one sort of Pentagon guy, the guy that actually tells the Secretary of Defense what tech to buy, and make sure that he can't receive any news, any emails, any messages, any internal communications related to your massive cloud bid or this weird project where your company is partnering with the Air Force, that shows how serious they were early on. So in the months ahead, here's what's going to happen. Google and also a bunch of other industry players around Silicon Valley are going to come up with a set of principles that they say is going to help them to understand what their ethical requirements are when they work with the Pentagon. That's going to be very transparent to the Pentagon, and the Pentagon will have a sense of that, and then they'll know what they can ask who to do. So the arrival of those principles, which we learned about first, and now we know is going to employ different characters around Silicon Valley, not just Google, but very much led by Google, that's the next step here, where everybody drafts some rules, and hopefully the folks at Google that, you know, the actually writing this stuff like the principles, but we don't know yet, we haven't seen them. That's what happens next, and that's going to guide this relationship going forward. And then Google will probably feel a lot more comfortable to start talking about this stuff. But, you know, that's the thing. It seems difficult for me to imagine any sort of ethical guidelines that you could write that would allow you to that would appease folks that say, you know, to the heads of Google, I'm sorry, I actually just don't want to be a defense contractor. You're making something that's going to help facilitate faster and more lethal military activity. It's part of that lethality thing. I'm still out. But either way, those principles should add some clarity and allow more folks that want to get out to get out. And the folks that are on the fence can make a more informed decision.
Well, I guess we can keep following Defense One or NextGov to see what happens next. Patrick Tucker is a tech editor at Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
So one big security story coming out this week didn't come from RSA or our SA. It came at the Wall Street Journal CEO Council Conference in London. Security researcher Nicole Egan told the story of hackers who used an internet-connected fish tank thermometer to hack into a casino. Egan said the hacked fish tank thermometer gave hackers a foothold into the whole network through this IoT thermometer. They were able to find a database of high-rolling gamblers and then pulled that information through the cloud-connected thermometer. Didn't even get wet on the way up to the cloud. So next time you ogle that fancy new IoT toothbrush, coffee maker, or fish tank thermometer, know that you are expanding your attack surface, as they say, and putting more of your data at risk.
Gosh, I mean, that's like the prime example of where we are right now with IoT and security and why people are freaked out about it. And there are things that you just don't think of as being a vector, but everything is a vector nowadays.
Yeah, she didn't say what the name of the thermometer company was or the casino. That's all sealed up.
But. Or any of the high rollers.
No.
I'm curious.
No, she gave those names and addresses and phone numbers and social security numbers will be on our website. We have them. We wanted to share them with you as well.
Man, this whole IoT thing, I mean, there needs to be some sort of regulation around it. Like, it's to some point, to some degree, where you're picking up an IoT device and you see that sticker on the box that says certified or something so that you know that it's protected from a security standpoint, because these things do not cost very much. And that's part of the problem. It's like low cost, you know, companies, businesses, people are buying them not because they're highly secure, but because they're easy to get. And you don't think about, like, the alternative, what that trade-off is.
Right.
Ugh.
I do like my internet-connected coffee cup, though.
How secure is it, Megan?
I don't know.
What kind of high rollers document is someone getting through your coffee mug?
I don't know, but you know, when I interviewed Rachel Toback, who does the she competes in the social engineering competition at DEF CON every year, and she kind of looked at, you know, we did this exercise where she looked at my Instagram and showed me all of the things that were dangerous, and I had taken a picture of my Ember mug, my internet-connected mug, and she was like, right there, like, I know you have an internet connected coffee mug, and so I've got everything, Megan. If you're pawned, as they said.
So you have pawned.
I always want to say pawned.
Pawned. You've been pawned at the shop. Okay, so
do it every time.
You use the internet connected coffee mug. Do you actually have it connected to the internet when you're drinking coffee from it? It's a mug, right? It's not like an internet-connected coffee maker.
Oh, I have that too.
Oh, okay.
And the vacuum and the lights.
And literally everything in my house. Oh, my goodness. Ah.
You know, yeah. It's just it's like locks on the door. Just an invitation. Yeah. It's just a suggestion. Don't come in.
Right.
But, yeah, I'm an open book.
Yeah. Totally pawned.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
Send us your selfies. Send those to tnw@twit.tv. We want to see how you watch the show. We like to see your pretty faces. And subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnw. And if you're planning on being in the Bay Area, come visit us so we can see your pretty faces live in our face. Get your free tickets at tickets@twit.tv. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
I wish we actually gave them tickets. Yeah. We're just like, yep, you can come. That's your ticket. Yeah. We should really work on that. We should really get tickets.
Yeah, we should make them.
We could sign them. To make them official. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to Burke, Josh, Jammer B, Colleen, Alex, basically everyone who helps us with this show each and every week. And thanks to you for watching once again. We'll see y'all next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.